Okay, we're on after a short break. I would like to hear about the beginnings of your work with Riki Kobayashi at Rice. You talked a little bit about going to him for advice about what to do next after show, and he said he had a position. And so,
I'm not exactly sure what we've covered, because I'll try to be concise. Kobayashi was a brilliant man, and I was very glad that he wanted me to work with him. And it sounded like it would be interesting, and it would give me freedom as a young bride to do whatever young brides do to establish my life and all. So the first thing we did was to do a consulting job, because he was a young professor and didn't have any money. And so we did a consulting job and designed a styrene plant that I've shown to my integrators. So, and Rob, what is that word? Oh, I didn't say it right. At any rate, we did this design, and then he had enough money to pay me to work for him. And we did a book called Handbook of Natural Gas Engineering. Donald L. Katz is the principal author. He was a head professor at the University of Michigan and had done a lot of investigation into natural gas engineering of all aspects, and had a number of former PhD students. I think there's about five or six of them, who are co-authors on the book. And Kobayashi and I were responsible for three particular sections, and I've forgotten exactly which they were, but one of them was the gas hydrates, which is what Riki had done his doctoral work on. And I think separation, distillation was one. I've forgotten. I've got it written down in my official bio. But at any rate, I went and worked in the library. I had a library Carol assigned to me where I could accumulate it. And at that time, all of Rice's material was in the library. Rice had a very large central library called the Fondren Library at that time. And whatever the particular topic was that we would have, I would go and use the chemical abstracts index, which every chemist and chemical engineer is familiar with, and find all of the articles back to the creation year on that particular subject, and develop the complete bibliography of the topic that we were doing. Kobayashi would write the material for the section, and I would review his writing to make sure I understood it, and to make sure that I thought other people could understand it. And he would revise according to my comments. This particular aspect of my career continued for many, many years, where I would review primary writings by other people and point out places where it could be improved from the standpoint of understanding the material. And the raw material that I gathered, in some cases, had to be developed into a chart or graph where the information could be presented in a very concise form. And I did this. And this particular aspect, again, prevailed throughout my career and subsequent life. I have the ability to gather a set of data or facts or information and to distill it down into a format that can be more easily understood by others. Anyway, I continued to work with Kobayashi on this book until it was completed. And in the meantime, I became pregnant with my first child, and we bought our first home and moved into our first home.
So this work on the book took about how long?
Let's see, I left Shell in February. I went to work for Riki in May. And June was born. So then I went to work for Riki for May, and I worked for him through the following May. So it took, including writing, doing the styrene. That styrene thing must have taken 4 or 6 weeks. So his work on that book with me was 10 and a half months, I would say. I spent 10 and a half months working on it. Riki had to do the fine proofs and everything. and he had to get all of the stuff that I did in drawings had to be made into a formal drawing to go into the book.
Was this full-time or part-time?
I was working full-time, I think, during that time. But I could take off if I wanted to, you know. It wasn't like a 9-to-5 punch through. But John was working full-time in his research at that time and working very hard, too. So we'd both get up and leave the house at the same time. And John had a car and I had a car when we got married, and we kept both cars so we could move about independently. First thing we did when we each got married was to buy, each finished school was to buy a car. I got a Pontiac. It had some initials or something. You know, they have names. Oh, they have a great big Pontiac. Oh, man, I love that car. And John got a little Chevrolet coupe with no air conditioning. I had air conditioning in mind. Of course, he came here from having been at Indiana, and I was here in Houston. I knew you needed air conditioning. that was funny. But we both had the same philosophy about cars. You buy a car and you buy it to be a car, not to be a status symbol, and then you use it as long as you can before you buy another car.
So what was rewarding about this work? I heard you prior describe this as one of the highlights, doing this
work. Oh, working on that book?
Mm-hmm.
The highlight was more the subsequent date on the other book. But this was particularly gratifying to me. I learned a tremendous amount in doing basic library research into what other people had done, and then correlating that information into new ways to present the information as a summary. Information is no use if it's just sitting in a desk drawer someplace. You have to have it out in a form where it can be used. And I really liked being able. And it was a pretty big ego trip, really, to be able to do it. I mean,
to achieve it, or to be entrusted with it, or what was gratifying?
That I could grasp the information so quickly. I was really amazed at what I could do. And it was very gratifying. It was very gratifying to be a very young engineer, 1 year experience, and to be participating in something that has turned out. The book is still in print, is still being sold, and is now, of course, available in electronic form. And it's still being used worldwide, because you can design a complete gas plant using the information in that book, but it's much better if you have it supplemented with the other engineering data book that I worked with later in my career.
I'm trying to recall what the gas industry was like then, but is this sort of that seminal work for the industry that helped enable things, or do you know what kind of impact it had beyond the longevity?
It probably had an impact on the industry in that the GPSA, gas suppliers, Gas Men Suppliers Association, which are the service industry to the people that went out and produced it, developed from it the GPSA engineering data book. It already existed in a pamphlet form, which had nothing but the graphs in it, no directions on how to use it. And this book tells how to use it and how to do all the, you know. But the GPSA book at that time was a pamphlet of about 20 pages of graphs, and you had to know how to use it before you could use it. And probably this book led to that. I do not know that particular history, but it led to the development of the first, about the eighth edition or so of the GPSA engineering data book. It went through a lot of editions, and I've forgotten what the numbers were when I finally ended up working on it many years later.
sounds like you were mainly working with Ricky on this.
Only worked with Ricky
okay.
on this particular, yes.
Okay.
It was a strictly a one-on-one relationship.
Uh-huh.
I had no interaction with the other members of the faculty at all. This was his private endeavor as a young professor trying to establish himself.
Okay.
Gas hybrids are very important. They were, what happens if you have water with natural gas? Natural gas is methane and ethane and propane. And it's essentially it's what you burn in your stove if you have a gas stove, mostly methane. And if you have this in a pipeline and it's just a little bit of water in it, and you have certain pressures, you can form an ice-like thing called a hydrate, which is a crystalline form solid like ice, only it's not at your normal 32 degrees Fahrenheit. This is at 60 degrees Fahrenheit in the pipeline. And if you get, you have a pipeline and you're trying to flow something through it, and it suddenly decides to turn into, quote, ice, or really hydrate is what it is, at 60 degrees F, you can imagine, oof, and it won't go no more.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very important when they finally found them, trying to figure out what they were. Hammerschmidt is one of the great names in that research. I remember that one. And they had just, in the 53, 54, was when they finally were figuring out what the actual structure was. And I mentioned this before. Before computers, crystallographers would be trying to think about what it looked like. And they literally had to sit and think and imagine these things. They didn't have, maybe some of them did make some sort of very crude modeling, but they had no computers to model things. Today we can have the computer and give them something, and the computer can take it and rotate it and show us it from all sorts of different angles and directions. How they did what they did, because these structures were very complex. The papers were published, was that, I'm trying to remember whether that was 1960 when I went back. That must have been after I went back that that happened, yes. But the whole thing is getting information to where people can see and understand and use it is really very important. And I didn't realize how important it was while I was doing it.
Well, it broke new ground, understanding gas hydrates and the
yes. And understanding and the gas to reduce how to design a natural gas system of all aspects of it, like this book did.
Right.
Because it covers production as well.
Can you talk a little more about why gas hydrates in terms of out in a pipeline and such, why it's an issue? Is this an efficiency or safety or?
If you've got a line that you're trying to push a product through and it stops working, it gets plugged, would you be very happy if that was your business? That's why it's important. It plugs the line.
So I'm imagining years later, there's something called the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Was this thought of in that installation? Or?
I personally participated in a consulting job that resulted in the defining conditions for hydrate formation in two fields in Alaska. And from that, I developed a generalized correlation that was subsequently put into the natural gas processor's official water content chart, and that served as the design guidance for many, many years. And it has subsequently been verified experimentally that my line was conservative, so it's the kind of line that an engineer likes to have. And yes, it had definite impact.
And had done a little looking at sort of natural gas and how much the U.S. uses.
Mm-hmm.
But over these years, I guess in a way, you've enabled this lower price, more almost ubiquitous natural gas through all this work.
The economic analysis I've never participated in, but I can tell you, first of all, by using cryogenic gas processing, you get a cleaner natural gas product in it, that it has more methane in it, and you have at the same time retrieved the ethane and propane and butanes, which then are your feedstocks for ethylene, propylene, and polybutane, and polybutylene, and all of the other plastics. So, I mean, it has a tremendous impact on not only the gas industry, but on the plastics. And I am not an economist, but I can easily visualize it must have had a tremendous economic impact. The hydrates things is just another aspect. As I mentioned before, there's so many different parts of it, and transport of product. It does me no good to have gas that I could burn in my stove if that gas is sitting on a platform in offshore California and I'm in Texas. It's got to get from California to me in Texas for me to burn. It's pretty obvious. Is that what you were trying to get at? Okay.
All right. So I think then at this point you talked about you got your first home and you started to have children. So can you talk a little bit about those years of, beginning a family?
I call them my production years.
Uh-huh.
And I had three daughters. It was 20 months and, let's see, is that right? When June was born, July. Janice was born in February. And Juliet then was born in August, so it was 56, 58, and 59. And during that period of time, I did do one or two very small consulting jobs with Kobayashi that he would call me in to work on, which I liked. I mean, it kind of kept me alive. And after my third daughter was born, frankly, I was bored with talking about the best way to wash diapers and how to take kids to the doctor and can we, all of the things. I was bored with child raising. It was not challenging to me. I didn't like sitting down reading books to little kids. My husband did that. He read to them from the time that they could crawl up in his lap hardly. And I loved to read. And I loved my children. I liked them very much. And I took good care of them. But I really didn't like doing it. And I wanted the intellectual challenge that I had, because preparing that handbook of natural gas engineering had been very intellectually challenging. And I didn't have that anymore. And so I wanted to go back to work. And my mother-in-law objected strenuously to this. She did not think it was the thing to do. But I wanted to do it very badly. And John, and I so talked to Ricky again. And Ricky said, "Yeah, come and work for me and Tom, and we'll find some way to pay you." Tom, being Professor Thomas W. Leland, Jr., who was a brilliant theoretician. I mean, we have him in chemical engineering, too. And Ricky was a very brilliant experimentalist. So together they made a very powerful team, and they both had a very strong interest in the basic thermodynamics of the light hydrocarbons, which was the field that they did their work in for many, many years. And that laboratory worked together and produced tremendously, tremendously influence on gas processing during the 60s and 70s when I was associated with them. And so I became part of their research team. And what did I do? Whatever needed to be done. When you're doing university research, you have to get, if you're doing it in a scientific or engineering field, you have to get financial support for equipment. And equipment can be anything from a pencil and pen and a calculator to do calculations on to a Van de Graaff generator as an extreme example. I think the Rice at that time had built a special building for a Van de Graaff generator in the physics department. And so, you know, I'm just trying to show that. So as a professor in a university and you want to get something done, you've got to go out and raise money. You've got to raise money. You do this by writing a proposal to two types of things. One is government institutions, and one is private companies. The other is private companies or private institutes who gather money to be spent on research or have money to be spent on research. And you have to convince them that your idea is worthwhile of investigation and support. And so your proposal has to say what you're going to do, what you're going to hope to accomplish, and you have to have a budget with it. And that's 90% of it is, you know, wishing. You've got to ask for enough. You've got to be reasonable enough in asking, but you've got to ask for enough to, and then you have to ask a little bit more than that because you know they're not going to give you all of it. And so maybe you make the same proposal to two or three different entities, so you get 20% of your support from this one and 80% from that one, and therefore you have the 100% that you need. But you start off asking both of them for the 100%. It's all sorts of, but you have to write these things, and that takes a big chunk of research time. It's one of the things that's very wasteful, in my opinion.
But you were involved in writing some of those proposals?
I was involved in editing. I did not write the proposals. I did not go out and seek the places. The professors did. But then, you know, they would make their graft. And maybe I would have to do some, you know, we need this, this, and this type of thing to invest. But then I would read it and see if it really had, ever really asked. And then the other thing is, everybody has a different format that they want it to be in. I am an expert on format. I can do anything. And you have to take this one in this format and change it to this format. And I'm twisting my arms to show that. I mean, one is completely opposite of the other and backwards. And it's, this is true of writing papers and everything. And I am very, very good at that. I can manipulate any sort of format, and I have rough drafts in there that I could show you where you've gone from one to the other. But I spent a lot of time working on proposals. And you have to make sure you've got it exactly right and all this sort of thing. Okay, the other thing that I did then was helping this program was a big program. We had a lot of PhD students and a smaller number of postdoctoral fellows who would be there for 1 to 2 years. These people come in and they're in a new situation. They need guidance on everything from where to, you know, where to live, where to buy, where to go shopping, whatever. They need a lot of hands-on help, and I provided that. One thing I told them was, you know, I took them around and showed them where our facilities were, okay, and this is the secretary of the department. She's the most important one. She knows where to get your paycheck for your stipend that your support. Okay, and then we would go down to the machine shop, and I would introduce them to Ray, what was Ray's last name? Wilson? At any rate, he was our machine genius, and he could build anything. Okay, that's the second most important person, because he's going to keep your equipment running. And then the third one, of course, you've already met, Kobayashi. He's the one that's in charge. And it was this sort of thing, that and different ones, so that they knew where things were, and they knew that they could come to me if they had a question of, you know, to find out things. Mm-hmm. So many of these, and then I would, as I became more and more experienced, knew more about what was going on and everything, every day I would walk through the laboratories. Sort of like a doctor making the rounds type of things, and see and talk to them about what they were doing and what, and offer suggestions or ideas or ways of interpretation. I remember the day we had a man who was measuring vapor pressures very, very of all the paraffin hydrocarbons and trying to make a correlation of his results and in trying to develop, try to think. I spoke to him about how to feel like a molecule. And this led to eventually to the correlation. But the idea is that a methane, if you double up your fist, and that's the methane, it's just a single piece, that's the carbon in the methane. Okay, but then if you have ethane is composed of two carbons hooked together. So you imagine your elbow being the next ball, and that's that. And then the third carbon onto it is called propane, and they are hooked together by the intermolecular forces, like your arm is from your shoulder, and your arm to your shoulder, and that's fixed and solid. But then you get, when you put that fourth compound on it, look what happens. You can swing the others around it, and you have another degree of freedom going on. And from that, we eventually ended up with a generalized equation for the vapor pressure of a hydrocarbon mixtures. So, but going and that type of idea and interact, that's what I'm talking about, why it's important to talk to people. I provided certain ideas, they provided interaction, you know, where it first comes from, but you've got to have that stimulus. But going around is very important to see everybody and talk to everybody. And when eventually they would get to the point of writing their thesis, I would review the thesis before it ever went to their committee and make suggestions on trying to make it more acceptable.
I mean, in some ways, this seems like a dream job. You get to kind of engage with lots of different people.
Oh, it was very interesting. And at the same time, especially when I started out, when I first started, we had this computer, the Royal McBee LGP-30, in six hexadecimal language at 16K of memory, 1960. And the first thing I did was to program this computer to do what we called corresponding states calculations in those days. And corresponding states calculations involve double sums multiplied by double sums divided by double sums. And then finally you apply an equation of state, and the equation of state equation is such that when it goes and it hits the phase envelope, and then it flops over to the other side of the phase envelope, and in between it does a double turn. So if you're using what's called the Newton-Raphson technique to try to converge on your solution, you can get three solutions. And so my early attempts at programming using this before we finally figured out what to do, I would put it in to operate and go home, and I would come back the next morning. The output was in paper tape, and it would be this huge pile of paper tape where it had flopped from one solution to the other solution and back again all night long. And we finally figured out what was going and managed to modify it and get it to working. But it was amazing that I had no training in how to do programming, but you just learn by doing it. In later years, we developed at Rice in the electrical department the Rice computer, and my office was what was called the Abercrombie. That's been recently been torn down, the Abercrombie Laboratory, and on the opposite end of the chemical engineering department was at one end. The opposite end was where the electrical people were. And on the third floor, they put in the Rice computer. The Rice computer room was approximately the size of my house here. It had an elevated flooring with all of the cabling running underneath it. And it had these racks and racks and racks of cabinets with all of these tubes in it, the old-fashioned radio tubes is the only way I know to describe it. And then there was the control console. Well, everybody has seen Star Trek or Star Wars, and you've seen the control. It looked exactly like that. And you had all your little switches that you could switch. and you had your cabinet here, again with the lights and all, that showed your fast register, so you could look there and see what they were and read the lights and know what it was. And then your fast printer over here that printed a whole line at it. Oh, first of all, just printed out one letter at a time. Then we got one that was a fast printer, printed a whole line at a time. And so I had to then convert my program to the language. And of course, they had their own compiler language called Genie. Wasn't a Genie at all. And so I had to convert it to that. And so I very carefully wrote up the entire program, which was pretty complex, in this new language, and went in, and they had input as paper tape. Now remember, this is an experimental computer. So they were experimenting on the computer part of it, both the hardware and the software. So I get it all typed up and ready to go. Go in, and I've learned how, you actually had to operate it yourself, and I learned how to put the bootstrap in and to get it to start operating, how to read all the little lights and everything, and it would not compile. And would not compile. In the meantime, the period between I'd done this original thing until I wrote this particular program, you know, they had changed the software, and they had a comment. In the original software, they had a final, you did a line of code, and at the end of the line, you had a place to put a note to say what you were doing, and I'd used that copiously so I could keep track of what I was doing. They had eliminated the comment line, so my program would not compile. So I had to go back and edit my tape and take out all of the comments before it would compile. So that was that aspect of computing.
And how did you share use of the computer? Like, were there certain hours when you were able to use it?
Oh, it depended. Computers, it depended on when you were. Remember, this is over a period of 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it varied quite widely. Originally, we had the one computer. It was only for the chemical engineering department.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, Leland was the only theoretician on it, so he was the only one. So he was sort of in charge of who could do what when. And really, there wasn't that much competition for it because there weren't that many people using it.
Hmm.
I mean, I used it, and I guess Jim Leach did. Somebody else. There must have been other people, but it was, we were barely knew what we were doing with computers in those days.
Hmm.
Later on, before we got the Rice computer, we got an IBM 1620, and it used, we had to share that with the entire campus. And you would, it used Holley. The first computer used paper tape for feed. The second computer was the six IBM. It used the Hollerith cards. Do you know what a Hollerith card is?
If you could give a short explanation, that would help.
It's a card about 4 inches by 7 inches, and it has one corner cut off of it, and you punch holes in it, and it goes through a reader that reads those holes and then translates that into some type of information.
Mm,
that's a,
okay.
Basically a Hollerith card. And you had to punch your own Hollerith cards in the university. You didn't have somebody else to do it for you.
And one card was like a line of code?
Usually, yeah. One card was a line of code, yeah.
Hmm.
So it was very hard to keep your stack correct and not drop it. That would be it. And, of course, being a university, there was a limited supply of Hollerith cards, so I snuck a whole box and hid it in my office so I wouldn't run out of cards. universities are great places to work. But those had to go over to the, I mean, this computer was so important. You had to turn in your cards for the operators to run your program and then get your result back.
Mm-hmm.
That was that. Then when the Rice computer came, the Genie, I never had any problem, you know, being able to use it. I was able to get in without having to sign up 3 days in advance and stuff like that.
Okay.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It was quite different. Did we record my husband's computer story? We did that?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, the computer is very, very interesting. Had a huge impact on me and all the rest of the world. When John went to work for Shell in 1955, he started using a computer in his work. And they used the Hollerith cards for input. But he was in a company research, and you know, they knew how to take care of people's time and everything. So they had special people to punch the cards. He would write it out in his handwriting, and they would read his handwriting somehow or other, and punch the cards. And then another person would punch the cards, and they would compare the cards to be sure they agreed. And they would have a say, okay, this really is what he wanted. And then they would pack that up and ship it off by special courier to the airport and put it on an airplane and fly it to New York City, where Shell had their computer, naturally. 1955 to 1960. And they would run it, the programmers, the operators of the Shell big computer would run his program. I don't know what they had, but it was bigger than what I had at Rice from 60. And then they would send the result back by airplane, and the output was in continuous. If you haven't seen it, imagine a piece of paper the size of your newspaper that just goes on and on and on, and it folds every 18 inches or so, has an automatic folding process. And so your output from your comes out as a computer printed output that is a continuous long piece of paper, and you have to go through until you find what you want and look at it. But that was the output. So that would be put on an airplane and flown back to Houston and taken by courier from the airport to his laboratory in West Houston. That was the state of the art of computing. And then I went to Rice in 1960, and I get the introduction. And then we get the introduction to the when our children were growing up. And everybody would sit at the table, and we'd be talking about computers and stuff, and the other kids would come in, they wouldn't know what was going on, and would be very amazed. And then our son, first of all, one of our daughters went and studied computing at University of Houston, and then our youngest was a son, and he comes along and he studies computing at the University of Houston. And one summer he gets a summer job working on the Cray computer. I don't know whether you've ever heard of the Cray or not, but it was one of the first of the supercomputers. And so Jack worked on that. And then after he finished then he got a job part-time working, and then worked for them immediately after his graduation on the genome project. I mean, computers throughout our life, my family life, have been very significant. Jack ended up having a very distinguished career as a computer consultant. He could go in to a company that was having problems with your computing in your office, and you're not getting the results as soon as you want them. He can go in, he's now deceased. He could go in and go around and talk to people, and by the end of the week, he would tell you, you need to buy this, this, and this. You need to have this, this, and this, and you need to institute this, this, and this. Make a complete analysis of what was needed by the company to make their computer operations be fruitful. He was a brilliant, and he was expert on, and he ended up, some of his final clients were some of the biggest names on Wall Street.
So you have four kids.
And four children.
And a couple of them were in STEM fields, it sounds like.
Well, let's see. June became an engineer. Janice was first a professional musician at age 16, but then she was going to major in music. She was a brilliant jazz saxophonist, but realized nobody was making a living just playing the saxophone in Houston. And so then she went into computer, and she majored in computers. And Juliet did major in music to begin with, and then became a CPA. And then our son majored in computer engineering. So three of the four went into the STEM field directly.
And you know, you're talking about you had the computers early on at home.
Yes.
In addition to the children's exposure to computers through the home, to what extent were they going to, you know, Rice or to your other workplaces, either yours or
your husband's,
and seeing what you did
there.
I
don't think they ever went out to Shell, but I actually, in my work at Rice, I had a lot of proofreading to do. We did a lot of publications. So showing you my stack of publications. And every time you do a publication, you have to do a final proofing of what you get. And you have to proof along the way on all sorts of things. So I did a lot of that. I thought these were proofing stories. But there were times when I would have things that had tables of numbers and numbers and numbers, and I would bring them home, and I would get my children to proofread the numbers. And they can remember doing that when they were quite young. So they learn. Well, we tried to raise our children to be very independent. First, I started when they could barely crawl up to the kitchen tower top, and I would be making biscuits, and they would help by cutting out the biscuits. So they all learned how to make biscuits and do the basic things so that they could do something about. It turned out to be a good thing. They learned how to cook, and it was good. Various things happened in life. They all knew the basics of how to take care of their own clothes and to use the washing machine and how to run the lawnmower. Everybody knew how to run the lawnmower. Everybody learned how to change a tire on a car. They just learned to be independent. And I think it was a good way to raise my children. They were all fairly independent. My daughters were, I guess because I had always wanted to play an instrument. I had, growing up, you know, the conditions we were in, going back and forth, I had studied guitar when we were in Big Spring for a year and a half. And then finally, after we got our home, when I was in the ninth grade, my parents bought a piano, and I got to have piano lessons for 2 years. Freshman and sophomore years in high school. So I had had some music, formal music training, and I liked it very much and everything. So I wanted my children to have that opportunity. So when my oldest was 7 years old, she was at this age, her dexterity had developed to the point, and her able to read and everything well enough to start learning music. And so we rented maybe we did it before then. Jack was 2 years old. 62, she would have been 10 years old. Is it that late for her? I don't remember. At any rate, we had the upright piano. And she started taking music lessons, and her two sisters after her did the same thing. When Jack came along, Jack had to be induced prematurely, and as a result had some brain damage and had learning problems. So in his physical dexterity did not develop well at all. But he tried piano, and he just couldn't cope with it. So, but the girls did study piano, and when they went into Indian elementary school, ready to go into junior high, the junior high music director was very driven man, very much. And he came over when they were in the fifth grade to get them to start a horn so that they could play into the orchestra. Well, the oldest girl ended up with oboe. My second daughter wanted to do the harp, and we took and let her have a trial with the harp teacher, who was, of course, the harpist at the symphony. And she sat down, and she told her what the strings were and everything. And Janice proceeded to play the theme from The Sound of Music. So all of my daughters had quite a bit of musical talent. Janice had a tremendous amount. Well, then we found out that to play the harp itself in those days cost $10,000. And you had to have a truck to transport the harp, the big harps, you know, you're talking about, because there's little harps you can play. So we persuaded her to not play the harp. And so she first tried the French horn, and she didn't like it. And she went to the saxophone and loved it and did her career on saxophone. And then Juliet came along, Lo and behold, she took up the bassoon. So they all three played musical instruments. And when June was finishing junior high and getting ready to go to high school, Ruth Denny finally persuaded the Houston School Board to form a special school for the performing and visual arts. That became the High School for the Performing and Visual Arts. In the very first year, my oldest daughter was a three-year high school at that time, sophomore, so she was the beginning. So she started there. And I formed my second parent-teacher association. The first one, or maybe it was the third, I've forgotten. Anyway, I had formed, in our first, when we first bought our home, I helped form the PTA association there for that school because it was, I didn't have any kids in the school yet, but I helped form it and organize it. And then I formed one for maybe it was only two. At any rate, HSPBA, we formed the Parent Teachers Association. The teachers, the parents were the producers, and the teachers were the directors. So instead of the parent teacher, it was the Producers and Directors Association. But they all three went to HSPBA and did their music training there. And the middle girl, when she was 16 years old, started playing with a lot of the Latin bands professionally and became a member of the union at age 16.
These are amazing, accomplished kids. And I'm thinking about sort of today's time when often women, but now both parents, will struggle to keep down jobs at the same time as raising kids.
Oh, my husband thought I was superwoman. He often called me, I was a supermother. I was room mother. I organized PTAs. I was a scout leader. I had a child with special needs that Carl had lots of special problems with. If there was a drive to walk down and knock on the doors and bring, you know, the March of Dimes where you ask for a donation to, I've forgotten what they all were, I would always do that. And I liked to sew, so periodically I would do things when the girls were in junior high and they formed a little band and they all wanted to have the same jacket, and I made a jacket for everybody in the group to make it. So
people today struggle to quote-unquote balance all that. What tips would you give people for how you did all that?
You do what you want to do and like what you want to do. John liked to read to the kids, and I can remember, and I have pictures of him even holding our grandchildren and great-grandchildren sitting in a big Pullman chair that had been his grandfather's chair. And they would crawl up and he would read to them every night. And he would take them to the library to get their books, and they would come out with this huge stack of books and everything. We both were very much involved with our children in what they did and encouraged them.
And how did you coordinate your schedules with your husband and with your children?
Well, you just tried to plan everything. John and I both were active professionally, of course, and had to travel away from the home. And we always had to check with each other before we could go anyplace. I remember one time when I was at the university and I was working for the National Science Foundation has a review process before they make awards. And I was one of the reviewers for the Presidential Young Investigators Award. And the other reviewers came from whatever cities they were. I was in the middle location, so they came to Houston. And rather than meeting at a hotel, we met in my home. Because you have a tremendous number of papers, like we would need this room, and we would have them spread out all over these tables in order to review the material and all. And I was investigating and working on that. About 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the phone rang, and I answered it, and it was my husband. And he had said he had just been offered the opportunity to be Shell's exchange scientist with their laboratory in Holland. And I said, well, that sounds fine. We'll have to, I can't really take time away from what we're doing. We'll have to discuss it tonight. And that was probably the ultimate discussion that we'd had many more discussions before about this meeting and that meeting and not both being gone at the same time. But that was the ultimate discussion, and that led to our year abroad. But raising the kids, it was a joint effort. I don't see how anybody is a single parent, male or female. How in the world can you manage? But of course, my grandmother did it. My mother did it. But in today's society, well, my best friend forever down the street from me, she has no children, and so she tried having an exchange student live with her two years ago. And at the end of the year, she was just exhausted. She's her degree is recreational therapy. And as part of that, she also does massage therapy. And so she goes to people's homes and the very severely disabled have to have massage therapy to and the mentally challenged people have to be taught how to go out and eat in a restaurant. That's the recreational therapy aspect of it. Well, that's just one of the simple things that she tries to teach them. And so she had her career, and then she had this high school student that suddenly has to go to and from high school and to take care of all the high school. And she managed it for a year. And at the end of the year, I talk to her every week when I'm having my massage. And it's truly amazing. How in the world can a single parent ever survive? It's a very difficult situation.
I have a small question, which is, what was there any reasoning behind naming all your children with the J names?
Well, my husband's name is John Emerson. And so then we started having children. And I wanted to name the daughter June, because that was my roommate at Rice. I really liked that name. And Elizabeth just seemed to go with it. And it turned out that was J-E. And so we kind of said, well, you know, we'll keep with that. And so then we did Janice and Elaine, and then Juliet Eve. And it turns out there's one syllable in June, and two in Janice, and three in Juliet. So we finally, with my fourth pregnancy, we were going to have the name be George. And John decided he was born. No, we need to keep J.E. And so it became John. And the Emerson, which John Emerson and Jack Emerson, my husband's father was named Emerson Burns, Chapelier. So that came along. And so many years later, when Juliet adopted her children and had to give them names, one of her sons has Emerson as his middle name. So we've kept it going in the family.
Very nice.
During your time at Rice, I'm kind of reflecting on the 1960s. So there's the moon landing, and you live here in Houston. There was didn't JFK make that famous speech at Rice?
The famous speech at Rice, yes.
What's your memory or involvement in
it? I don't remember the speech. I remember the landing on the moon. In fact, when I did my genealogy training in Provo, and there was a young student assistant who was in his senior year of college, and it was a small group of people. I said, what's the most significant thing that, you know, happened in your lifetime? And to me, the landing on the moon was the most significant. And this young man says, that happened the year before I was born. And that, to me, impressed me with what age is and what happens. To me, it was like it was yesterday, and yet he hadn't been born.
So talk about that.
What is time? Time is such a difficult concept to understand in so many different ways. But so much of our concept of time is relevant to ourselves. You see it in the small child waiting for Christmas or waiting for my birthday. You know, and when you're small, I'm 2 3/4. I'm almost 3. Right? Well, you kind of refer to that when you get to my end of the spectrum, too. And it's just very interesting how your inner concept of time is related to how old you are. And yet, time is a very important concept.
So the most significant scientific achievement in your lifetime, you would still say, is landing on the moon? What would you say?
Oh, what would I say? At this stage in life? Yes, I think that is the most significant thing. Now, the computer development is huge, tremendously important. I'm not belittling any of the other accomplishments that have happened.
So landing on the moon, how is that significant for science? How did you relate to that? I mean, you had kids by then too, right?
Oh, yes, I had all my children by then. You said it's. I think it's the most significant. Did you say scientific accomplishment?
Mm-hmm.
Or, yes, I think it was. Well, it was more than scientific. That's why it's the most important. Because philosophically, humankind has been released from the boundaries of being on Earth by landing on the moon. And the more that I know philosophically and religiously and scientifically, the more important that event becomes.
Do you remember watching it or hearing news
about
it?
Oh yes,
what was
I
that
remember
like?
Watching it.
Uh-huh.
Like vividly sitting there. The vivid memories in my, I remember December the 7th. I remember watching that event. Of the events that were worldwide, you know. And I remember 9/11.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you remember what you were thinking at the time when you were seeing it happen, the moon landing?
When I saw the moon landing? Elation. Humans have finally broken free from being tied to the earth. It felt tremendously human. I guess it was. Freedom.
Which is a different kind of memory than these others, which were sort of.
Yeah,
seared in memory.
Yeah,
they were.
You're very, very tragic and,
right.
And frightening. No, this was not frightening. This was. It was beautiful. It was. And it wasn't just one individual. It was an accomplishment of humankind.
Having been in science and engineering, did you feel that was kind of a special moment versus others? Or the humanizing aspect sounds like it's a universality.
Well, from an engineering standpoint, I had a tremendous desire to do some of my experiments in a zero gravity condition. In fact, we tried to get some of our stuff on, and we never could get it accomplished. No, from an engineering standpoint, of course, you have, oh, what can we do next? Oh, look, here's a new toy for me to, you know, these computer toys. I have a friend, and she always had to have the latest and greatest in the computer toys. Whatever happened, she was a brilliant woman. But There are people that are history junkies or news junkies or something, and they really have to have it. Well, she, that was it. The idea of trying something new out is just... A cook always wants to try out a new recipe, right? A real chef. A real chef is challenged by creating something new. I think that's sort of a basic human urge to tinker with things and make them a little different.
So other things going on maybe in the later 60s after the moon landing was, I guess, something called Women's Lib. What was your kind of reflection on that period of time?
Well, I guess my reaction was, it's high time, baby. I did never participate in any things. I think I felt like that simply quietly being myself and doing and accomplishing what I could do was enough. And we had the same time, that was the same time that we had all of the racial problems. Houston was unusual in its reaction to the race problem. And we had I still have, certain people who are very influential in the city. And it's not well known, but at the time, the black influential people, leaders, met with the white influential people, and they said, our city isn't going to have any riots, and we did not. Mm-hmm. The details of that are documented elsewhere, but it really happened. And today, Houston is the most integrated cosmopolitan area in the United States. We have more of every different type here than any place else in the greater Houston area. And yet we still have tremendous prejudice, areas of very high prejudice and intolerance. Very challenging. From a sociological standpoint, it's a real... A lot of very interesting things have gone on in my lifetime.
Kind of an international city, but yet not, in a way.
No, it is international. It's tremendously international.
Were you involved with something with the Society of Women Engineers?
Yes, I told you that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we had one of the earliest national conventions here in 1958, I think it was, 59. And our society had to... I've been active in organizing professional meetings throughout my entire career. That was one of the smallest that I was active in. And all nine of us in our local chapter of Texas had a subcommittee. We had about 60 registered women engineers from all over the United States, or people who call themselves engineers, come. A lot of them brought their spouses with them. So for the party, the official banquet, we had 100 people attend it. We had one black female, and whatever her name is, Clark something or other, I've got it, came. And the meeting was at the Shamrock Hilton Hotel. And of course she could not stay at the Shamrock Hilton. She couldn't even come in as a delegate without an official guide, host, caretaker of her. And so accommodations were found for her by one of the black leaders, one of the black pastors here in town, who's extremely well known for her. And they brought her each day to the meetings, and we met her at the front. And this was when the Shamrock Hilton was a fancy hotel, and you had the chief bellhop guy out there, the fancy uniform and all that kind of stuff. And we had to be there and meet her and conduct her throughout every meeting into all of the rooms, and when she went to the restroom, she had to be escorted and everything. And it we weren't going to have one of our guests be treated as a second-class citizen. And she attended all the meetings, went to all of the events that we had, and we made sure she participated in everything.
And she was an engineer.
She's a civil engineer. Furthermore, she told me she worked for, in Tennessee, I think, for the state or something. The only time, she told me a story, it's hilarious. The only time she ever supervised a concrete pour, she was 8 months pregnant. I thought that was really funny.
Did you have any other engagement at this point with other black engineers, or as time progressed, did things become more integrated?
Let's see. I never had any more interaction with black engineers during that time. It was only towards the end of my career, in the late 70s and early 80s, that I began to see black engineers at ASCHE meetings. And subsequent to that time, there have been a lot more blacks. We had no blacks at Rice, of course, during that time. I did deal with a very large number of international students from, some from Europe, some from Mexico, none from South America. I had a woman from the Philippines. I showed you her picture earlier. I showed you the picture, the one from the Philippines. We also had the one from Japan. Which one did I show you? Anyway, we had two women. Those were both women. And had one from India. He was interesting. With the caste system and all, and this is something we had to learn, your social background makes a difference in how you look at things. And he had to learn that Ray Martin, the machinist, was a very important man. And you didn't look down on him because he worked with his hands. See, he was from a society where it would have been unthinkable for him to change his own tire. And, to me, that's, well, change your tire? I don't know how to change a tire. I may not be strong enough to do it anymore, but I sure know how. And it was different. And I also found, and I don't know whether other people have found this, I dealt with a lot of people who were from the Orient, who had Koreans and Japanese and Chinese and Philippines, and their native language was an Oriental-based language. And the man from, where was he from? Afezagili, from one of the Middle Eastern countries. Their language structure is different from the language structure of English. And because of their language structure, sometimes their analysis process is different from our analysis process. And I had to learn how to communicate with them and try to understand the way that they were looking at things. And at the same time, trying to learn for them to learn how to communicate in English. And that's when I fell back on my training in diagramming that I had gotten the first time I was in the ninth grade. And it was tremendously helpful in doing that. But I found it very interesting. To me, the organization of how to do things, and I can best illustrate it by using cooking to make a cake. Do you both cook? Have you cooked? Have you made a cake?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what's the first thing that you do when you make a cake? You put all your ingredients out, you turn on your oven, you prepare your pans. You take your bowl and you put your stuff in and you just do all the mixing. You put it in the thing and you cook it. Okay. That's our description of how to do things. Okay, now the Oriental description of how to. I'm going to make a cake. I'm going to put pink icing on it and use these decorations and serve it with these forks and spoons. I'll mix it, be sure to beat the egg whites first. I'll bake it at so-and-so. and they'll have the whole order of things is completely different from what we would organize the way of going about baking a cake. If that makes any sense, that changes, if that is the structure of your language, and it's not an exact analogy, but if your language is structured like that, then the way that you analyze things is quite different. That probably was one of the biggest challenges in all the years that I was working there. Communications.
So we're talking about this whole period from Rice, and you mentioned, as we were talking about family, the move internationally.
Okay. Well, Rice was my, from 1960 to 1975, that was my career. During that period of time, I, as I said, I did participate in lots of different research efforts. We periodically would have consulting jobs, like the one for the hydrate formation of the for the natural gas pipelines in Alaska, that would make a lot of money. I had my children raised. I want to go back and do a little bit more approach what you're talking about, mm-hmm. so I get my chronology straight. In 1962, we were doing a major consulting job, and I was working in Dr. Leland's office at that time. I still had my own office, but whatever I was doing for the consulting job, I was doing in his office, and it was a joint contract that we had for some big thing. I was working like 40 hours a week at that time. Normally, I did not work. I was not normally on, quote, half-time, but I actually worked longer hours than that, and when we'd have a consulting job, I'd work very long hours. But at any rate, I was having, I was pregnant with my son, 6 months pregnant, and I had a grand mal seizure, and I woke, the medics hanging over me, and my husband, and Tom. So I was out for quite a bit of time. And of course they took me to the hospital and I spent the night in the hospital and they did what they could do in those days. They could check your blood pressure and take a x-ray of your head. And you go in 6 months pregnant to have an x-ray done and the technician turns white. As white as this blanket. And she drapes me up with all of this lead stuff and did x-ray the head. And they did an electroencephalogram, the electrodes on your head where the measures, what they could do with that. That was all they could do to find out what was wrong inside your head in 1962. And so from those results, and they could look into your eyes. That's the other exam that they did. If you look into the eyes with a like this, and you probably have had an eye exam like this now where they look and they're looking at your blood vessel development. They actually do it with a machine nowadays. They go poof and take your picture. But back in those days, they peered at you. And if they're doing the neurological evaluation, they peer for a long, long time. And if your neurologist smokes a pipe or a cigar, it is very, very uncomfortable. It speaks the voice of experience. Ugh, I can still remember it. But at any rate, they determined I was 6 months pregnant. I could probably go ahead and have my child okay, but I would have to, you know, I probably had a brain tumor from what they could see. So I had to stop working, I had to stop driving a car, stop raising my hands over my shoulders. I don't know what that had to do with it. Essentially, stop doing everything. And remember, this is in the middle of when I'm raising a family and all, and I'm doing a consulting job, and I'm running around like crazy. And it was a very difficult time. And as we drove home from the hospital, John and I talked, and we agreed that, you know, if it, you know, came to the choice of who should live, me or the baby, it would be me because we had three little girls to take care of. And it was a very difficult conversation to have. It's a very difficult concept to deal with, but we did, and we did it together, and so I went ahead. But I was going in every week or every week to this doctor, this neurologist, And he and I told John when Stone was out, John, I'm going to need a psychiatrist. This is more than I can deal with. And turned out the neurologist was also a psychiatrist. So I started counseling with him at that time. Well, after looking at me and, you know, continuing to be monitored by the obstetrician and all, and then finally the neurologist thought he could see changes in these eyebrows. Now, I've never looked at the eyebrows, but what little I've done on looking at some of the medical stuff, how they interpret anything from that is beyond my capabilities. But he thought it showed that the so-called tumor was growing and that they needed to do the surgery sooner than he thought. So they wanted to induce, and the obstetrician delayed him for another week, and then Jack was induced 3 weeks early. And my children were large children, but Jack was induced 3 weeks early. He only weighed 6 pounds and 6 ounces. My other children were 11 and 12. One was 12, 16, 12, 14. You know, I had large, yeah. June was only 7, 8. See, so Jack was premature at that weight. And the pediatrician came in and told us that he was having difficulty breathing, the same difficulty in breathing that killed the Kennedy baby about the same time, just before this time. And he didn't know whether he was going to live or die. Well, he did live. Well, in the meantime, they could do more testing on me, and they had another test that they could do called a pneumoencephalograph, where they put you in a chair like this and strap you down, and the chair is in a cage like a girdle wheel, that little one's the little, and they spin this around, and as they spin it around and turn it around, you are displacing, they displace the spinal fluid with some sort of something, I'm not sure what, a gas or something, and then they can displace it up into your head, and then they can take x-rays of the head and see other things inside your head. This test is no longer used now that we have MRI. And you have this horrible headache afterwards. You literally, you know, you have to be flat on your back for about 2 weeks for it to go away. And so after they did it, they could see all where all the blood vessels were and everything. And they decided that no, they didn't see the evidence of a tumor was in my blood vessels on this side of my head. And the evidence was that the blood vessel was flat instead of being curved. But it was so small that if they did surgery, they would do more damage than if they left it in place and watched it. So that I then proceeded to live for the next several years, not knowing whether I had a brain tumor or not. And I continued under psychiatric care, and I had bouts of severe depression where I could not work, where I would contemplate suicide, get the razor blade and hold it in my hand, call my best friend, and she would talk me out of it. And somehow or other, I kept working most of the time. And finally, I was able to have a brain scan, and they couldn't find any tumor, and I was discharged. But that took a huge part of, it was also going on all this time I was at Rice in the 60s. Which is why I stayed there as long as I did, partially because of my medical condition. So I actually could not participate fully as I wanted to in a lot of things. And I never knew when this would. And every 6 months I would be ready to go in and do this, and of course you would become very tense, and it's like you get all upset before you have your period. Help me, this was a little worse. So.
And you mentioned that friend who was supportive. How did, if you were working with Ricky or others, how were your colleagues around
Rick,
that time?
They were, whenever I had to leave, I left. And they were completely supporting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had complete, full support from them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, remember, Ricky had a brain tumor too.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I mean, sometimes a lot of this wouldn't have been shared back then, right? Medical issues and associated with pregnancy, postpartum depression.
If you fell down and had a grand mal seizure right there,
right in the office,
they'd know about it. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It was a difficult time. It really was. But Jack did survive, and I was traumatized to the extent my mother, of course, came out to help take care of me and everything, and she took me every day up to the preemie ICU that he was in for 2 weeks, took me up there to see him and everything, and I cannot remember ever going to see him. I have completely wiped that out of my mind. It's amazing what the mind can do. It must have been very, very traumatic for me. But anyway, so you were asking now about my so that was part of my of why I did what I did during the 60s and 70s. And in the meantime, it was really interesting working and meeting all of these people and learning all of these things. And I went to all the the natural gas supply. I was the only woman going to the meetings. And in those days, they would have the final Wednesday night party would be men only. And I didn't get to go to those. Stuff like that. It's quite different nowadays. Quite different. There weren't any women in those days who were, who owned and operated the gas companies. Nowadays there are. It's a lot of difference,
So I wonder if maybe before we go to the living abroad, if we should talk about more about some conferences.
Okay, let's break.
Should we
stop?
Okay.